I want to tell you about one of my favorite places. I'm looking out over an enormous alpine valley on the northern edge of California's Sierra Nevada mountain range. Cattle graze near an old weathered ranch house, and a two-lane road meanders through a small town in the foothills.
It's a beautiful landscape, but the people who live and work here face some tough decisions about the future.
Urban influences are encroaching on my land and my life and on the aspects of the community that I think are important.
I'd say if most people had an idea in their head of what the town's going to look like in 5 to 10 years, they'd be shocked and they'd probably say, put the brakes on.
Urban development threatens rural communities across the Sierra Nevada and around the country. And people are trying to find solutions to sustain their rural way of life. Here are three stories.
Saving the Sierra, after this.
You're listening to Saving the Sierra, grassroots solutions for sustaining rural communities. I'm Jessica Maria Ross, and along with 100 million other visitors every year, I head to California's Sierra Nevada to get into nature and get out of my day-to-day grind.
There's something just totally spiritual about being in such a wild place that you just never experience anywhere else.
You know, Lake Tahoe has always been very special. It is the most beautiful, wonderful place.
Yosemite Valley holds wonderful memories for me.
It's just such a wild and magical place, and every few feet you move, you see something new.
It's true. The Sierra is amazing. What I love is hiking in the foothills just a couple of hours from my home in the Central Valley. But these days, every time I drive up, I come across some swath of cookie-cutter homes that are carved out of the landscape. And these subdivisions, they always have names like The Ranch or Rolling Oaks to remind me of what was bulldozed under.
Despite what a lot of folks think, the Sierra isn't just a wilderness area set aside for tourists. I'm Catherine Stifter, one of a couple million people who call the Sierra home. And by the year 2040, our population is expected to triple. I live in the middle of the forest, and I sure don't want all those new homes next to me. I've put down roots here, and I like the peace and the quiet. I worry what kind of changes the next wave of Sierrans will bring.
The truth is, everyone who lives or works or plays in the Sierra is shaping its future all the time. Ever since Indians managed the land for food and wildlife, there's been a need to preserve the environment so it can sustain people and their livelihoods.
Jessica and I traveled the Sierra in search of communities where people are learning how to do just that. And we've found stories worth sharing because they just might be solutions for threatened rural places across America.
We begin way up north in Sierra Valley, where generations of ranchers have worked the land and raised their family for over 100 years.
I was born here in the valley, lived here all my life. Farming is a way of life. You have to love it. You don't farm and say, well, when I'm 65, I'll sell and retire and go to the city. That thought never entered my mind. I'm still working at 97. Like I told my family, I hope I die with my boots on out there working on the ranch.
Attilio Genasi leans on his cane near a timber frame barn and gazes across 100,000 acres of sagebrush and meandering streams. The only breaks in the horizon are a few ranch houses and a low rise of Indian mounds in the middle of the valley.
It's a beautiful, beautiful valley. Some people say it's the largest alpine valley at 5,000 feet elevation in North America. When the snow's on the ground, you see a blanket of snow. You can hear the train on the other end of the valley at 18 miles. You hear the clickety-clack of the trains that go by. It's so quiet and peaceful here. And I think I want to save it for posterity. The land does not belong to me. The land belongs to future generations. And the land also belongs to the general public. They drive through this valley. They enjoy it. It doesn't cost them a penny, and it doesn't cost me a penny. It's one of the natural wonders that's there for humanity. And we dare not destroy it any more than we'd cap the geysers in Yellowstone or put the Bridal Veil Falls of Yosemite in a pipe.
Genasi's a bit of a legend in the Sierra Valley, and he's been an inspiration to other ranchers who have roots just as deep.
Hey! I'm Tony Madalena from Sierraville, California, and I am a cattle rancher. We've got some of our rancher friends together, and the kids from college have come home, and we're doing what we call the fall branding. We do it one weekend and help the neighbors other weekends, kind of throughout October, November.
I'll just explain to you what they're doing. See, then he shortens up that heel rope. The guy on the head's changing it from off of the neck so they don't choke onto the feet. Okay? Todd's going to put a brand on his hip. Julie's going to castrate him. Sean's putting an earmark on him, and the other girls gave him their shots, and with any luck at all, they're not down there very long. We're doing a job that needs to be done as far as the cattle business, but also we're having a blast. We get to be around the things we love. We're out in the open with our horses, our cattle, and our dogs, and our friends, and our family.
I believe that the biggest threat to our business and our industry in general is development. And it's very scary because the big developers have a lot of money and a lot of power and a lot of influence, and they're coming.
Developers are a threat because they buy ranches and build subdivisions that take up lots of open space. Residential development also threatens wildlife habitat, and the Sierra Valley has the biggest wetlands in the entire Sierra Nevada.
I'm Paul Hardy, the executive director of the Feather River Land Trust. And as I look around, I see a couple willets, some pintails and some mallard ducks, a few coots, and the ever-present singing meadowlark. There was one right there. In the Feather River watershed, we have a very unique relationship to land still. Whether you're driving to work or going fishing or just hiking around the community you live in, people really interact with the land on a frequent basis here. And growing up in the region, I sure did and felt very fortunate. When we started out as an organization, we tended to take a very ecological approach where we would identify the most important properties based on species and habitat and things like that. Oh, there's a sandhill crane out there. Yeah, cool. More and more as we work with the local communities and landowners, we realize that as important is protecting relationship to land.
The Feather River Land Trust protects open space by helping ranchers stay in business. But big developers move quickly when and if ranchers are ready to cash out.
For example, just to the north of us, the Bonta Ranch, a 1,700-acre ranch, was just bought by one of Reno's largest developers, and it's being parceled up and subdivided and sold. The threats are definitely there, and the values that properties are selling for in Sierra Valley have just skyrocketed in the last couple years. We're going to have to work smarter and faster and more creatively.
There are plans to build 400 homes on the old Bonta Ranch. The Sarasola and Schaffner ranches were bought up too. If all these developments are approved, in just a few years, there will be 3 new subdivisions and 1,400 homes, where now all you see are vast wetlands and rolling foothills along the road that leads to Reno, Nevada, just half an hour from here.
My name is Norm Brown, president of NC Brown Development, Inc. We're a small development company. We do land and development, principally higher-end custom lot projects.
Brown plans to build 30 large homes on a 245-acre ranch he bought on the edge of Sierra Valley.
The baby boom is aging. They like to go fishing, they like to play golf, they like to hike. Now they're ready to retire and they want to get back to the outdoors again.
How can we keep the county rural and keep our lifestyle and still get a more robust economy? More people is not necessarily the answer. The grow and spend and spend and grow way of doing things, it doesn't work. There has to be a better way of doing it.
There are those that will say, we don't want anything built. And that's this kind of, I'm here, close the gate mentality.
It's just not appropriate for there to be a development in the Sierra Valley.
Stevie Duber manages a citizens group called the High Sierra Rural Alliance. Their mission is to protect the rural experience. She's been labeled an environmentalist.
And there are a lot of people in Sierra County who, you know, would rather shoot themselves than be aligned with enviros. And enviros is meant as an insult. I sort of have a hard time being offended by it. Probably the best way to protect the valley is through conservation easements.
Easements are tools that landowners can use to protect open space.
When you own a piece of property, there's development rights, there's timber rights, there's water rights. Quite often, you can split one of those rights off and sell it to someone else. So in the case of the ranchers and the easements and land trusts, the rancher owns the land. The only thing that he can't do is develop it.
Well, for me, it was an easy decision.
Attilio Genasi was one of the first to put an easement on his property.
You don't give up anything. You continue to farm it. You can lease it. You can sell it. But that contract with the land forever.
This ranch right next door to us here, the old Strang Ranch, they may have lost it maybe 5-6 years ago when Mr. Strang died. They may have lost it all or had to sell a major part of it to pay the estate tax. And they put a conservation easement on it, got some money for that easement for not subdividing it. And now the ranch is in place. It doesn't really change too much of what they do to operate. And it's still in ranching and always will be.
I always think of the easements as rewarding landowners for the public benefits that they're providing. People are getting more and more in touch with those values that open spaces and ranches provide.
So far, a quarter of Sierra Valley, about 30,000 acres, is protected by conservation easements. And that's because it's a strategy that ranchers, environmentalists, and conservation groups are all getting behind. But there's no guarantee that this is going to save the valley, because it's up to each individual landowner to decide whether it's the right thing to do.
One thing about the conservation easements that the skeptics of the conservation easements have against it is that it's, perpetuity. What's forever to me is when you pave it over. You pave it over and you put buildings on it, it's never going back to the way it was.
It's estimated that the Sierra Nevada alone loses 35,000 acres of ranch lands, forests, and oak woodlands to residential development each year. We invite you to go to our website, savingthesierra.org, to find out how conservation easements are saving open space in rural communities across America.
But residential development pressures are just one of the issues facing rural communities. In our next story,
almost everyone who lives here makes a living off the resort community. But it's a challenge because it has changed the beauty and the natural element that we all came here to enjoy.
Making resort development pay for its impact on the community. Next on Saving the Sierra.
You're listening to Saving the Sierra, Grassroots Solutions for Sustaining Rural Communities. I'm Catherine Stifter.
And I'm Jessica Maria Ross. Hey, I'm going to need a jolt of caffeine to wrap my head around this next story.
Me too.
I can help you guys right here.
Hi, I'd like to get a single latte.
Okay.
Catherine, what do you want?
I'd like iced coffee. We'll put it right here on the counter for you. Here's your iced coffee, and your latte will be right up.
Hey, Jessica, look at this.
What?
You can't even pick up a newspaper these days without reading a story about how resort development is the inevitable future for rural communities. Wall Street Journal, page 1. New gentry, wealthy folks are colonizing rural America. And that's their word for it, colonizing.
I've heard some of the worst mountain sprawl in the West is along the I-70 corridor out there in Vail, Colorado, down towards Denver. And then there's Gatlinburg, Tennessee, the gateway to the Smokies. Hotels, motels, rental cabins everywhere.
When massive tourist development started here in the Martis Valley, just south of Truckee in the Sierra, people worried it would be the end of their clean air and good water.
Not to mention put more traffic on the roads and the trails.
And that out-of-towners buying vacation homes would raise housing prices so high locals couldn't even afford to live here.
Environmental groups said, that's it. Game over. We've got to stop this right now. And they sued the developers and the county. The lawsuits went on for years, and the controversy nearly ripped the community apart. It seemed like a solution was never going to happen.
But those long, drawn-out negotiations resulted in a new approach. The folks involved in the negotiations believe the deal they struck is a way forward that will benefit everyone, from local families and business owners to the folks buying their luxury homes and even the developers doing business in resort communities like Truckee.
Our first stop is a little boutique clothing store just down Main Street from the local coffee shop.
Well, hi, how you doing?
I'm fine, how are you?
Good, good to see you.
Good to see you too.
My name is Stephanie Olivieri, and this is my store, Cabona's, here in Truckee.
Okay. Thank you.
This store has been in my family since 1918.
Okay, you can look over there a little bit.
I've grown up in the store. Actually, my mother let me come here to work when I was 9 years old. It was my first job, and I loved it.
Thanks for shopping with us.
No, you're welcome. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So now I think we should go out to the Martis Valley. I'd like to take you out there and show you the special places that mean so much to me.
The way Stephanie looks and talks, she wouldn't strike you as an environmental activist.
You're going to follow me over.
She dresses in matching outfits with fur-lined hats, drives around in a big green Range Rover.
We're headed out on Highway 267 into the Martis Valley. It's covered with this new fresh snow, but all of this is sagebrush and valley. And when I was a young girl, this road was a dirt road. My brother and I would fish all day through these little fingerlets of creeks, up into the mountains, up to the beaver ponds, and the valley was covered with cattle. There wasn't a single home here except for the one rancher who lived in the valley. What's this guy doing? Gotta be kidding me. In that big a hurry? The road that runs through Martis Valley is traveled by the people who are heading to the ski resorts. On holidays, it's usually bumper to bumper. It can take you hours to get to North Star and hours to get back from skiing. So all the development that's being proposed and has been given entitlements is going to add a huge amount of traffic to this road.
Stephanie's been concerned about how her hometown's been changing for a long time. 20 years ago, she helped start the Mountain Area Preservation Foundation, and she was a key player in the Martis Valley litigation.
We're going to be turning now into the wildlife reserve area of Martis Lake. The most important thing out here is if you look to the... I'll roll the window down for you. If you look due east, you see that there's nothing on those mountains. It's totally open. The animal corridors remain intact, and the habitat remains untouched. That area is slated for close to 3,000 units of resort development. And for the environmental groups who were involved in the Martis Valley litigation, it's our priority to save that area at all costs. So shall we get on our snowshoes? Beauty in every direction. I love it when the snow is falling, especially up in the high mountains, you can see it. It just takes my breath away, makes my heart pound every time I come here. Almost everyone who lives here makes a living off the resort community. And certainly my clothing business is resort-oriented. Everyone's torn because they certainly need the development for their livelihood, but
it's a challenge because it has changed the beauty and the natural element that we all came here to enjoy. I think what I've learned from being in business here and recognizing the need to balance business and environment is that if we do it wrong, there won't be a benefit to business or this community. We have to get it right. And in getting it right, the community will benefit. Those people who come here to experience the outdoors will benefit. And we will have a sustainable economy and environment here.
Most folks here in Truckee don't own their own businesses. They work at the ski resorts, the hospital, or the lumberyard.
They're making small-town wages in a place where affordable housing starts at $250,000 and goes up from there.
We headed over to one of Truckee's more affordable neighborhoods to talk with an ex-ski bum whose frustration with trying to find a place to live landed her in local politics.
Hi. Welcome. Ooh. This is Lulu. She's friendly. This is Dylan. Can you say hello? You're being a little shy. Can you do part of the alphabet for Jessica? Remember A, B, C, D? My name is Nikki Riley, and we are sitting here in my house in Glenshire. I was living with my husband, Brendan. We kind of did the ski bum, restaurant work stuff. We were clued in by a friend that there was a house for sale in Glenshire, and maybe we would be interested in looking at it. We thought, oh my goodness, $285,000 for a less than 1,000 square foot home. This is outrageous.
In cities and suburbs, it might seem like a deal, but for young rural couples, it's steep.
We were able to scrape a down payment with help from my parents and Brendan's parents. $30,000. Who's got $30,000 at their disposal? And most people are living paycheck to paycheck. That's always been my kind of issue, is let's address what the stumbling point is for why people can't afford to buy in.
Teachers, nurses, and firefighters often can't find homes within 30 miles of their jobs in Truckee.
It took a couple of years to get involved at the community level. And then we had written some letters questioning the lack of affordable housing, the lack of impetus to get that ball rolling. Everyone's response at that time was, it doesn't pencil out. And we were like, are you kidding me? This is appalling. I mean, what kind of a community is this?
And that's when Nikki decided to get involved.
I had run for town council in order to give representation to young people and to bring awareness to the affordable housing issue that I saw as a crisis in our community. I didn't win the town council seat, but I was appointed as a planning commissioner. And so that was my entry into the political world of Truckee.
So Nikki was part of a growing group of locals who identified affordable family housing as a key community issue.
And they connected with Stephanie and the environmentalists who targeted traffic and protecting wildlife habitat.
So for the first time in this community, they combined their goals.
And what was really, I think, an amazing outcome was this collaboration and the desire not only to protect open space, but also to address the affordable housing issue.
Developers, environmental organizations, and community groups spent more than 5 years fighting it out. And they negotiated a solution that sounds pretty simple when you first hear it. They're going to make new development pay to sustain the community.
1% of the sale of every home and lot in major new developments is going into a fund forever. And that money will be spent to protect open space and restore habitat, create public transportation, and build affordable housing for the community.
This is about what the fabric of our society is going to look like in the region. And that's what planning and land use should be planning for.
That's Steve Frisch. He's president of the Sierra Business Council, which is headquartered in Truckee.
We went to Steve's freshly painted office, and he cleared a big space on his very cluttered work table for us.
We're looking at a map of the Martis Valley. It's roughly a 20 to 25,000 acre area north of Lake Tahoe.
Steve's a business guy, so he helped us do the math.
most of the major development will take place on the west side of the valley. The anchor of that development will be the North Star at Tahoe Ski Resort, which has about 2,000 additional units. Those units are going to go probably roughly in the $2 million range. As you go down the shoulder of the mountain.
Say a luxury home sells for $2 million and the transfer fee is set at 1%. That's $20,000 a home. That means North Star could generate $40 million.
As you go down the shoulder of the mountain, the next major development area is the Martis Camp area. Housing there will be in probably the $3 million range.
So then the 653 homes at Martis Camp are good for $70 million.
Immediately next to that is Lahontan. And next to that, as you go down the valley and come closer to the developed area of the community of Truckee, are the Timlick developments and the new affordable housing site.
That 1% real estate transfer fee could add up to nearly $100 million over the next 30 years.
It's a permanent source of funding to pay for community needs. To seal the deal, one of the real estate development companies, DMB Associates, will donate a prime chunk of land near the airport and the highway where they'd plan to build a golf course and luxury homes. Instead, it'll be affordable housing.
We met Anais Kane, the chief operating officer of the company, at the housing site.
Can we walk around?
Make it around.
See, I knew that this was a hiking boot deal.
Yeah. You didn't bring your Tony Llama?
I didn't. No. I should have. I should have known better.
I always loved the smell up here. You don't normally think about being able to locate workforce housing or affordable housing in a beautiful pine tree location like this. But that's our opportunity here, which is really exciting. And so as you're looking along, you can see we're not very far from Highway 267. You can look through the trees that way at the backside of North Star. Lahontan that we passed, the existing project, is right there. Mars Camp is really between us and North Star from this location. And Truckee, as you see where the highway goes, is really only about 10, 12 minutes. D&B Highlands is really the party to the settlement that created all this. Long term, one of the principals of Highlands Group, as well as myself, sit on the Martis Fund that'll be administering the future of this site with our former adversaries, now colleagues, on that board.
So the folks who fought over these developments are now colleagues on the board that will fund community improvements. That's a pretty amazing outcome. But one you want to watch carefully, see how it all works out, and to see who has a place at the table when decisions are being made about what kind of affordable housing to build.
$100 million seems like a lot of money, but I wonder what it will buy over the next 30 years, because the price of undeveloped property around the Martis Valley is bound to shoot up.
It's that balancing act. You can never forget that the financial vitality is linked in some ways to the physical vitality of the place. We're always working at that intersection.
And if we do it right, it'll work, and we'll have it all.
Stephanie's pretty hopeful about the whole thing.
We'll have a good habitat, we'll have clean water, we'll have good air to breathe.
Nikki's not so sure.
I'd say if most people had an idea in their head of what the town's going to look like in 5 to 10 years, they'd be shocked, and they'd probably say, put the brakes on, let's not approve another housing development until we see what impact this brings.
Ultimately, the outcome in the valley is going to be determined by these interests' ability to work together effectively.
For Steve, it's about making sure land use planning is fair for everyone.
And for the next 20 years or longer, they'll be working on implementing this vision. To me, that is a seminal moment in the land use discussion in the Sierra Nevada.
More coffee?
Nope, I'm good. You know, there's going to be a lot of money to spend on good things for the community of Truckee and the Martis Valley area. But there's a lot of development. 600 homes here, 2,000 homes there. It's still taking up a lot of the environment.
All the development that's been approved will blanket one side of the mountain with high-end luxury homes. I guess if people believe that development is inevitable, then maybe the best any community can do is find a way to make it pay for the things they need.
People here made their voices heard during the local land use planning process, and they took themselves seriously as stakeholders in the future of their community.
We invite you to head over to the website savingthesierra.org to find out how citizens are getting involved in shaping land use plans in their communities. And keep your eyes on Truckee to see how those plans work out.
Not only do folks in the Sierra have to deal with residential housing on agricultural lands and recreational development, our natural resources flow out of the Sierra to help build California's cities on the coast.
Two-thirds of every drop of water used in the state comes from the Sierra.
This is the Leavining Creek Los Angeles Aqueduct intake. We're about 327 miles from Los Angeles at this point. Leavining Creek comes out of this beautiful canyon to our west here, and the city built a little dam across where the creek was, and then built a diversion structure behind the dam that takes the water and puts it into a conduit, and at that point it's gravity fed.
But should a city have the right to drain an entire rural watershed just to get the resources it needs to grow?
Right now, our annual water use here in Los Angeles, potable water, is 670,000 acre feet. We're getting from mono 16,000. It's water that we absolutely need. Every drop of that water is precious.
Next, on Saving the Sierra.
You're listening to Saving the Sierra, grassroots solutions for sustaining rural communities. I'm Jessica Maria Ross.
I'm Catherine Stifter. In public bathrooms everywhere, saving water is no longer optional. These days, the faucets turn themselves off.
And most folks know not to let water run while they brush their teeth. Might seem like a simple thing, but when you're saving water, every drop counts.
Our final story is about how a whole city was forced to wake up to where their water comes from. It's about a new kind of relationship being forged between 4 million people in Southern California in the city of Los Angeles and the source of their water more than 300 miles upstream.
The story starts here at Mono Lake. It's a large salt lake formed millions of years ago. It's an important rest stop in the High Sierra Desert for migrating birds.
And it was a soup bowl of nutritious food for Indians who spent winters beside the lake where they gathered basketry materials for hundreds of years.
I just want to thank the Creator today for a beautiful, beautiful day from the Four Directions. And Creator, I thank you for the water. Water is our life. We're here at Mono Lake. This was the homelands of my ancestors.
There are others that have gone before us.
I'm Lucy Parker. My Indian name is Tewichichi, and it means roadrunner. Our people traveled across the Sierras from Yosemite Valley to Mono Lake to do trading, and then they would eventually intermarry with the tribe here in Mono Lake, the Kuseteka people. And then they would travel back into Yosemite and live there and go back and forth. Creator, I thank you for helping each and every one of us here, because we all have something here to offer. Yahweh, 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 I ask you for the blessings from this powerful lake, from Mono Lake. You know, standing here on the shores, I always think about our people that lived here, how they went out on the lake to look for food and moved camps around the lake, praying at the lake and coming down and washing their face with the lake and getting blessings here. As Native people, our vision and thinking is going to be different because we didn't learn out of the books. We've learned from our stories and generations of our people that have told us about these ways. We're still able to come out here and we're still able to gather all our materials to create our traditions because it's a healing lake. I always say I'm an environmentalist. You know that our people are the natural environmentalists here. We're the caretakers of the land.
Native people have a strong relationship with the lake today, and they've been able to help the more recent environmental stewards understand its decline.
I'm Jeff McQuilkin. I'm the executive director at the Mono Lake Committee. We're right out here on Mono Lake in a canoe. We're exploring one of my favorite spots on the lake, South Tufa and the Tufa Groves. I first heard about Mono Lake when I was in fifth grade. My science teacher, he was out there getting the word out about what was happening, and he gave this slideshow presentation for our school assembly, and I just remember thinking, wow, that's not right. While it makes sense that a city needs water to destroy that remarkable place in the process, it just doesn't seem like the right thing.
But that's exactly what was happening. McQuilkin's work as a canoe tour guide here helped him understand the power of relationships between people and nature.
The committee's run a public education program since before it was founded because we knew that if people didn't have an understanding of Mono Lake and a connection to the place, they weren't going to have much interest in protecting it.
My name's JJ Jenkins, but this is the 930 tour and the wind is perfect. There's an osprey flying right there above this big group of tufa. It's the larger, darker bird.
Do you know what birds those are?
Those are Brewer's blackbirds. Mainly in this area are violet-green swallows and Brewer's blackbirds.
The political story and the water story of Mono Lake start in the 1930s when Los Angeles began looking to Mono Lake in this basin to extend their aqueduct that delivers water to the city for a drinking water supply. About 1941, they opened the gates of the aqueduct. I mean, they took 100% of the flow. There really was no thought about what impact removing that water would have on the lake or the streams, the birds and the habitat here.
The city of L.A. was draining all the water from every stream that flowed into Mono Lake.
The lake had actually lost half its volume by the early 80s, and that put the whole ecosystem at the edge of total collapse. And in fact, the Supreme Court agreed and said, Mono Lake's a public resource because the people of California own the waters of the state. What would be right? You know, how much water could you divert and respect the public trust?
The court issued a landmark ruling in 1983, but L.A. continued taking water while a settlement was being negotiated.
It's amazing with all the larvae.
Tourists collect some of the trillions of tiny brine shrimp threatened by declining lake levels. They live on tufa, the towering rock formations created underwater by calcium deposits from cold water springs.
Yeah, they're actually mating in here right now,
mm-hmm.
as we speak.
Yep. Since we're so close to the tufa, I'll kind of show you the other food source here. The alkali flies. If you turn your attention this way on the tip of my finger, this is one of the pupae's, and you see a lot of the pupae on the bottom of the tufa, all those little dark specks.
Mm-hmm.
The Kutsavi Paiutes that settled here around in the Mono Basin, this was actually their main food source. Does anyone want to try it?
Sure. Slightly crunchy. Not a strong flavor.
Actually, they don't have much flavor at all.
I could eat those.
They need a little Italian dressing.
The Mono Lake Committee doesn't only educate curious tourists. They also reach out to high school students who live downstream. On a week-long camping trip, kids come from L.A. and they sleep under the stars and learn about the plants and the animals that live in this watershed.
Somebody tell me what's the age of this tree. How can we tell the age of this tree that burnt and died and fell? Okay, can you come and give us a count, sir?
It's a pretty smart strategy. Give young Angelenos a hands-on history lesson about their city's water fight with the Eastern Sierra. And in the process, teach them how their simple actions back home can protect Mono Lake.
¿Cuántos años?
190.
This was an old tree, you guys. This tree has seen a lot of change.
My name is Santiago Escruceria. I am the Outdoor Experiences Program Manager with the Mono Lake Committee. I'm in love with the Mono Basin. This is the biggest, sweetest, greatest outdoor classroom I've ever been at. I mean, you have the youngest mountain range in North America, the oldest lake, and then you have that Mono Lake story, which is something that I think everybody should learn about.
I'm Glenda Pepin, and I've been teaching science at Dorsey High School for 23 years, and these are all my kids.
No, we got a small one here.
I think that's chipmunk.
You think it's chipmunk?
Yeah.
And nice coyote tracks.
This program has, you know, just allowed them to blossom, and it puts them on a higher thinking level. So when we go back to school, there's a different level of wonderment and inquiry that comes from being here.
All right, go ahead and form that same circle.
When you're in the city, you hear about recycling and not using so much water, but it doesn't really hit you until you come and see the lake and see where it used to be and where it is now.
I think we just carry on what we learn here and we take it back into the city and we try to spread it out as much as possible.
Yeah. I've done presentations in college. Helping my sister.
Speeches.
We try to talk a lot about it back in the lake.
Okay, so Chris, I wonder if you would like to give our group a little talk about this part of the aqueduct and introduce us to what's going on here and the changes that have been brought upon this spot.
I'd be happy to.
Chris Plakos of LA's Department of Water and Power points students to the pipe that carries Sierra water directly to Los Angeles.
This is the Levining Creek Los Angeles Aqueduct intake. We're about 327 miles from Los Angeles at this point. It's a pretty simple system. Levining Creek comes out of this beautiful canyon to our west here. It collects in this little pond in front of us, and the city built a little dam across where the creek was, and then built a diversion structure behind the dam that takes the water and puts it into a conduit, and at that point it's gravity fed.
Although the California Supreme Court had ruled for the protection of Mono Lake back in the early 80s, it wasn't until 11 years later that the State Water Resources Control Board ordered L.A. to stop draining the entire watershed.
You'll notice that this dam, there's actually a big new notch that was cut into it about 20 feet wide, and it's open down to the bottom of the pond. That's the diversion structure that our staff built a couple of years ago to release a consistent flow into Levining Creek back into Mono Lake. So this is the point where the water used to be diverted. Now it's also the point where the water is put back into the creek.
And that's how Mono Lake has begun to heal. Snowmelt and rainfall in the mountains above can once again flow into Mono Lake.
And the lake levels are slowly rising.
Thanks, everybody.
327 miles down the aqueduct, these young folks and the other 4 million thirsty residents of Los Angeles were forced to change the way they use water, in part to make up for the Mono Lake cutbacks. And the city's become a leader in water conservation strategies.
Reclaimed water from household sewage is used to irrigate a large public demonstration garden on the northern edge of the city. That's where we met the president of the Los Angeles Water and Power Commission.
My name is David Nahai. And we're sitting on the steps of the tea house at the Japanese Gardens, which are situated right next to the Tillman Water Reclamation Plant. Green and picturesque, quite beautiful. It shows what you can do with recycled water. With respect to water conservation, I think we have done a very good job because, as you know, over the last 20-25 years or so, we've grown by a million people, but our water use has not grown at all.
Recycling and reclamation have saved water outside homes and businesses, and the city's gone inside to save even more.
My name is Dory Burry. I work for the Koreatown Youth and Community Center, and what we're looking at is a Niagara flapperless toilet. It's an ultra-low flush toilet that is unalterable and always flushes a predictable 1.6 gallons per flush. KYCC helped save several hundreds of millions of gallons of water. We helped distribute and or install 130,000 toilets, all of which, of course, was provided free by the Department of Water and Power.
There were some people that their reaction
why are you guys giving away the toilets? Is there a catch? Is there a catch? They couldn't believe it. I said, well...
I often credit Jose of being the number one single producing person in the Ultra Low Flush Toilet Exchange program. I think single-handedly, Jose is probably giving away 40 to 50,000 toilets.
Right? You know, things like that. Like I said, you know, you're telling me, you know what, it's mainly about saving water. Better pressure probably than the one you have because you have a 1940, 50, you know, toilet. So
Koreatown in central Los Angeles has a lot of properties that are easily 100, 120 years old. We have a lot of communities of color, very socially and economically disadvantaged, and don't have the money to replace toilets. There are some zip codes where we installed 75-80% of the entire zip code. As of now, probably about 95-97% of Los Angeles has low flush toilets, which is unfortunately why the program ended, because we did our job too well. We covered almost all the corners of the city. So what you see here is the graveyard of what was left, the last of the last of the toilet program. And I don't know if it's sentimentality or just pure laziness or being too busy, but we haven't had a chance to wreck these units, and I guess we will today, a couple pieces.
My name is Jerry Velasquez, and we're about to break a porcelain toilet. I'm putting on a face shield. It just protects my face, so the porcelain doesn't hit me directly in my face.
All the old toilets removed by KYCC were destroyed, just like these.
They grind them up, put them in potholes and other sorts like of cement mixes. So they use them for various projects so it all gets recycled. But they don't go back into becoming toilets.
The Los Angeles Department of Water and Power's Ultra Low Flush Toilet Exchange Program was very pivotal in the relationship between the city of Los Angeles and the Owens Valley and further up towards Mono Lake. And I think this program was the most visible urban water conservation program in the United States.
Our annual water use here in Los Angeles, potable water, is 670,000 acre feet. We're getting from Mono 16,000, even when the lake levels rise. We will at most get 25,000 to 30,000 acre feet, but it's water that we absolutely need. Every drop of that water is precious.
We follow the aqueduct north, back to Mono Lake, where Jeff McQuilkin showed us how a Southern California city and a High Sierra Salt Lake are connected now by more than just a need for water.
So this is just a great spot that we are. We're on the pre-diversion lake level, 6,417 feet above sea level. This is where the lake was the day that diversions to Los Angeles began. And of course, we're looking down through some willows and bushes to get down to the lake itself. As executive director of the Mono Lake Committee, I often get asked, isn't the lake going to come right back here? And the answer is no. That's not the goal here. The goal is to figure out a way to protect Mono Lake and its ecological health for the long term and help the city of Los Angeles with its water supply need. Well, we're standing next to some wonderful two-foot towers in the middle of the grass, and this is the 6,392-foot elevation. This is the place where Mono Lake will be in the future. We expect it to be about 2014, 2015. People ask me and us all the time, is the lake saved? There's two answers to that. You know, it has been saved from that water fight that we were fighting specifically with LA. At the same time, that's hardly the only issue out there. Now Mono Lake just faces every other environmental challenge that the state of California and this country face. So what we tell people who visit Mono Lake, whether they're from California or New York or Germany, is your water's coming from somewhere. Everyone has a Mono Lake at the end of their tap.
In California, two out of three people get their water from the Sierra. But as cities continue to grow and sprawl threatens rural landscapes everywhere, we're going to need to find new ways to ensure abundant, clean water and healthy habitat. It's really about stewardship when it all comes down to it. Recognizing that all of us downstream benefit by caring for the resources that these rural communities provide.
These three stories show there's no one-size-fits-all solution to dealing with development impacts in the Sierra Nevada. Jessica and I found that despite conflicts, people can come together to stand up for the values they share and find ways to protect what matters most: community, family, land, water. There will always be more problems, but these stories point to a way forward.
We invite you to head over to savingthesierra.org to find out more about the stories in this program and grassroots conservation solutions across America.
You can also hear more Sierra stories and share some of your own on our blog.
We dedicate this program to the memory of Attilio Genasi and his love for the land. Saving the Sierra was recorded and produced by Jessica Maria Ross and Catherine Stifter. Our story consultant was Claire Schoen. Mix engineer, Robin Wise of Sound Imagery. Music composed and performed by Ludi Henricks. Music recording engineer, Al Owens of Motion Music. Narration recorded at Rieger World.
This program is made possible in part by a grant from the California Council for Humanities as part of the Council's statewide California Stories Initiative. Visit californiastories.org.
Thanks to all the contributors to the Documentary Production Fund.
Special thanks to project partners, the Center for Sierra Nevada Studies at Sierra Community College, Sierra Nevada Alliance, and the Sierra Fund.
And all the scholars and advisors who helped us understand what's at stake in rural America.